my family loved to cook. My dad cooked, my mom cooked, my brother, my sister, we cooked together. We loved to cook in our family. And I would take the food section home with me at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would be sitting there reading it and thinking, why is it that the writing is so lame?
Did your mom or grandma tell you you had a smart mouth?
I'm Rachel Sutherland, and yes, felt like every day my mom did.
And I'm Donna Scott, and my mom sure did too.
And this is the Smart Mouth Life Podcast, where we're going to have a little fun and sometimes get really serious by talking about all the things that we've been told we were not supposed to discuss, but we've always wanted to.
And some things we're really just interested in with some people that we'd like to know better.
Cheers to the Smart Mouth Life.
This is Rachel. On today's Smart Mouth Life podcast, we're talking with Kathleen Purvis about journalism, Southern food culture, and career pivots. You probably already know this, but in case you don't know, Kathleen Purvis wasn't always a food journalist. She started out as a copy boy at the Palm Beach Post in the 1970s, and she said she wanted to just be in the newsroom, which is something I can totally identify with. And she's been around words and colorful characters ever since. For more than 25 years, she worked at the Charlotte Observer as the food editor, columnist, reporter, and she ran a weekly section and coordinated all of their food coverage. In early 2019, she left the Observer to strike out on her own and has since been nominated for a James Beard Foundation Journalism Award, which was her third time, FYI. She was a semifinalist in the Tales of the Cocktail Spirited Awards, and her work has been published in Southern Living and Garden and Gun, among other media outlets. She's published 3 books so far, because really, honestly, none of that is enough. And the most recent is Distilling the South. And I think she is just a walking encyclopedia of Southern foodways knowledge. So welcome, Kathleen. We're so happy that you're here.
Yes, well, thank you, Rachel.
Or we should call you Purvis.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there's always this big debate over my name, because the truth is I hate my name.
Why?
Even my mother agrees it was the wrong name. I'm not a Kathleen. I'm not the Kathy type.
So what would your name be if you got to pick?
Catherine. I would have been called Kate, because I'm much more of a Kate than a Kathy. Huh. But yeah. And truthfully, most of my friends for years and years, the people who've known me longest, are the ones who call me either KP or Purvis.
Okay.
And of course, in the early years, it was pervert most of the time.
All right, I will be calling you that for the rest of this podcast.
Pervert?
I'm proud to be a pervert, girl.
Okay, well, let's just start with some background. How did you start with all of the food writing? What motivated you? What made you interested in that? When did it happen? All that stuff.
Okay. Well, here's the thing, is I started out to be a newspaper writer, newspaper journalist, reporter, back in the days so early on that there were guys in the newsroom who, if you said, I want to be a journalist, they go, journalist, what the hell's that? You're a reporter. You're a newspaper man. So I really expected to spend my life doing hard news. And when I was at the Charlotte Observer, I came here to work a job that had me working late at night. I was a layout editor on the Metro desk when we had 6 editions a night. It was a brutal job. And I would go home at night, and I wouldn't take the paper home with me, because if I didn't have the paper to look forward to reading the next morning, I'd sleep too late the next day. But I would make one exception, and that was the night the food sections came out, when the pre-runs would come up and the food section would be there. I would always take the food section home. My family loved to cook. My dad cooked, my mom cooked, my brother, my sister, we cooked together. We loved to cook in our family. And I would take the food section home with me at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would be sitting there reading it and thinking, why is it that the writing is so lame? You know, formulaic, you know, focused on, you know, this sort of fictional mother with small children all the time, you know.
Right.
It really felt kind of grounded in the past, and yet I was so excited to read this stuff. And so I started looking around on my own and discovered there was this whole genre of food writing that I hadn't even really been aware of, wasn't huge yet at that time.
When was this?
This would have been 1987.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I went to, there was no food editor at the Observer. Both of the food editors had retired, Helen Moore and, oh, Lordy, I'm blanking her, Edie Lowe. And I went to them and said, you know, I really think that there's fun stuff that can be written here, great stories that can be told here, and no one is in charge of the section. And they were actually getting ready to kill the food section because it didn't have the same kind of advertising support the food sections used to have. And I went to them and said, you know, why don't you let me have that? I'll have fun with it. And they were planning to kill it anyway. And so they said, sure, you can babysit it until we kill it. And so I just decided, well, I'm going to keep that from happening. So I would go home on my own time on the weekends and at night, and I would make stuff and I would write little stories about it. And I would come in and say, well, you know, I could run this Wire story about this thing, or I have this piece I wrote about something happening in Charlotte. And they would go, okay, fine, run that. And readers started to respond to it. So I literally crab walked into food writing. I just kind of sidled in when they weren't looking.
And little did they know, you grew the baby up to be a whole fully grown adult.
Yeah, real. And then it reached a decrepit age and I had to watch it. You know, it's like that age is a man thing where it's down back on four legs again and kind of crawling along. Yeah, it was sad. But I did get to be a part of it at the best part of being a newspaper food writer.
I would say that you are the reason why it was the best part. It was by far, that's so interesting to think in just how a relatively short time it grew so much. It went from having no ads to being probably the most populated and in-demand feature standalone section, like when I was at the paper.
Yeah. Well, and the thing was, too, is that food writing was starting to change at that point. I came in before, I was sort of ahead of the curve. And then suddenly, you know, when I went into food writing, it was sort of like, why on earth? In fact, I saw an editor the other day, an old editor from The Observer, was there a million years ago. We were at a gathering, and I said to him, I have told this story on you a million times. His name was Ken Friedlein. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you knew him. Mm-mm. He was probably before Mm-mm. your time. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, you know, I went to Ken when I was moving over from the Metro, you know, national side of the paper, and told him I was planning to do this. And he said, you're a good journalist. Why would you throw away your career on food writing? And I love to tell that story and laugh hysterically because it's like, you know, yeah, you think maybe that worked out, kid?
Well, that actually dovetails perfectly into the what I wanted to talk to you about, kind of, which is the state of journalism today, which is generally really
sad and bad.
And
not
for news,
always.
No.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing.
There are little bright spots about
that. For newspapers, it's pretty grim.
It is grim.
But food journalism is thriving.
It is. It's on the upswing.
Across all platforms, especially online publications and select print mediums. So what do you attribute that? Just kind of a changing interest in food? Food is definitely like an entire standalone category now.
Oh, yeah. And it has become that over the last 10 years or so. Like, for instance, the Los Angeles Times recently restarted their food section.
Wow.
Really?
And repopulated their food staff. Which,
wow.
You know, that was in the wake of the death of the great and God, I loved him. He was such a cool guy, Jonathan Gold,
mm-hmm.
Who I knew lightly, mm-hmm. but, you know, admired him so much. And when Jonathan died, it took two food reviewers to replace him.
Wow.
He was that big of a presence. But yes, food writing has become this very dynamic area. And it's in large part, I think, partly because one of the things that food writing, when it's successful, has to do is plug into letting you think that you could do it.
True. Very true.
Truly. I mean, people relate to it.
Right.
You know, and that's what I saw in it years ago when I told them I wanted to be a food journalist was, you know, people love to, when you're writing about food, you're writing about how we live our lives. You know, if you write about business, if you write about mortgages, there are a lot of people who don't have a mortgage. You know, lots of people rent, or they already own, or they'll never buy a house for whatever reason. No one asks whether business coverage is news. Everyone mm-hmm. eats, and we all have to eat several times a day. We are physiologically required to do it. So we all know what food tastes like. We all know the experience of eating. We all have aspirations around the things that we eat. And so when you write about food, you are writing about something that everyone can relate to, as long as you write about it in a way that makes you feel like you're a part of it. And that's what good mm-hmm. food writing does. is it makes you want to go try that place. It makes you want to go have that experience. And even if you don't ever have that experience, it makes you kind of feel like you did. So, and then Twitter and Instagram, social came along, and social feeds into food writing so perfectly.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's this whole community out there of food writers. And, you know, the funny thing is a lot of us know each other. It's mm-hmm. a very small community in a lot of ways. Very, very, you know, there's this sort of club of us who know each other. And Twitter and things like that give you a way to be a part of that world.
Oh, 100%.
And feel like you're at that party.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you can watch me and Kim mm-hmm. Severson of the New York Times banter back and forth and feel like you know us.
Right.
Which
I tell clients all the time, social media, if used properly, especially with Twitter and also now Instagram, jumps you to the front of the line. So
yes.
if you can kind of stalk people in a non-creepy way, because you can feel like you're having, like, oh my god, now I know what Kim and Kathleen or Kim and Purvis are talking about, like,
yeah.
I see what they're thinking about, right. And if you're astute, you can pick mm-hmm. up on trends mm-hmm. and kind of see the subtext of conversations. But from a visual standpoint, there is no more perfect subject matter for Instagram than food.
Right, exactly.
If
doesn't
done
want to look
well,
at a good food picture.
It's just phenomenal.
Even a crappy food picture can make you want to look at it, you know?
It makes sometimes. Me want to screenshot it and send it to my yeah. team and be like, don't ever do this.
Well, it's exactly, but yeah, you're still screenshotting it, aren't you?
True, very true, very true.
Just spell the name right?
Exactly. So I have another question that is kind of more inside baseball, as we would say in the newsroom.
Says the bat.
Yeah. all this newsroom jargon. So there's been a ton of talk in Charlotte lately about James Beard Foundation nominations.
I know. Deep sigh. Do we have to go there again?
What are we going to do? When are we going to get one? Should we be like Savannah to get one? Should we be like Charleston? I don't really have time.
To go into all the reasons.
Well, there's that, but also I think comparison is important, but I also think really the best way to do it is to put your head down and work.
Gee, you're quoting me to myself. You know that. Yeah. Okay. That's usually what I say is put your head down and cook.
That is not my question. My question is someone told me that they thought what it's going to take for Charlotte to get a James Beard winner is for the city to have a restaurant... I know you like reviewer rather than critic, to have a permanent person, I guess, attached to the Observer or some other kind of flagship publication who is dedicated to reviewing restaurants.
Mm-hmm. And they have a point, because a legitimate, respected reviewer will bring in national people, not necessarily national attention from the huge majority of people who travel around, but the people who are the Beard Award judges. Now, remember, and I should clarify here, which, you know, make sure everybody knows, I was a member of the James Beard Award committees, and there are a number of them, but I was on the main committee that oversaw it all. I used to be the chair of the Book Awards. I helped to found one of their awards, the leadership awards, and then I did like a special liaison job for them for a while. So I was very inside the Beard stuff, know it very, very well. And one of the things I run into all the time with chefs here is myths about how they think the Beard Foundation works.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of the ways the Beard Foundation does work is that there is a large group of judges out there and committee members who do pay attention to what's rising up. They look real closely at what's being written about, what's being said. There are people that they pay more attention to, just like we do. When you're mm-hmm. looking mm-hmm. for who you're going to follow on Twitter, you're looking mm-hmm. for the most legitimate person. So there is a level at which having a really good reviewer can do that for you, for a city. It can bring attention. It can bring people in. I would give you the example of Hannah Raskin in Charleston, who I know, you know, gets very controversial with people who have restaurants in Charleston. But Hannah is very, very respected. And mm-hmm. You can see very clearly where Hannah is coming from when she writes reviews. In fact, if you really want to know about restaurant reviews, it's a great ebook that Hannah wrote called Yelp Help.
Really?
Yeah, it was. She wrote it years ago, and I still suggest it to every chef who complains.
I was going to say, who's the target for it? Restaurant owners and chefs?
No, it was supposed to be. She wrote it for people who were doing those horrible Yelp reviews. Mm. You know, my wife hates scallops, and she ordered the scallops, and she hated them. You know, like that's going to help anybody. Mm-hmm. There is actually a science and a thinking behind a good restaurant review, and Hannah articulates it beautifully in this little ebook, and it's like $4. You can find it on Amazon. Yelp Help.
Wow.
But the thing is, there are also cities that have risen up that don't have that, and Savannah would be the example. And in that case, you've got a Mashima Bailey at the Gray in Savannah who won this year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to go back and double check my results this year because after, you know, 18, 20 years, it runs together. Yeah. But, you know, who is so good, she cannot be denied. She cannot be ignored.
Right.
You've got Frank Stitt in Birmingham. You've got his Dolester Miles, his pastry chef who worked for him. You know, those people are so good, they're going to rise up no matter what. But yes, having a good reviewer, and by good reviewer, understand what I'm saying. Critic is not necessarily just the point of the job. The reason I don't like restaurant critic says, all I'm doing is criticizing. Hmm. And that is not what a good restaurant reviewer does. A restaurant reviewer tells a story. They tell you context. They tell you not just is the food good or bad. They tell you why is the food the way it is. What can you experience by going there? And at its heart, always remember, restaurant reviewing is consumer news. Because restaurants are about you spending your money.
Oh,
and a
100%,
restaurant review is about, should I spend my money there? If I spend my money there, what kind of experience can I expect? Mm-hmm. That's a big part of that world. And we don't really have that right now in Charlotte. And yes, I know, Kristen Weil, God bless her, unpretentious palate, is trying to start a new model. I'm a little concerned about how likely it is that she's going to get the following she needs to do that, because I'm not sure what the audience is that is going to pay. It's going to be people who already know this information.
Right.
You know, who are already on swapping all this information, who are already in the know.
Yes.
So the vast majority of people are not being reached. So the thing is, with a restaurant reviewer at the Observer, first, you know, understand that restaurant reviewing is extremely expensive.
Right.
And most papers are finding it doesn't pay. The Miami Herald, really good friends with, you know, the food editor there, Carlos Frias. And Carlos and I had this conversation many times before I left the Observer. You know, you spend hundreds of dollars to visit a place three times to get a real feel for a restaurant. And then you put that article up online, that review, and it gets 300 page views. You know, that's not really worth your investment.
Right. Well,
so the audience is approaching restaurant reviews much differently than they used to. So. And does it hurt us in Charlotte? You know, no. If you got a Mashima Bailey here, if you got a Greg Collier here, who is going to rise up and get that kind of attention, that's the more important thing, is supporting a restaurant that's really worth supporting.
I want Charlotte as a whole to just kind of take a deep breath and be like, I'm so tired of us being compared to Atlanta, and I feel like we're always the bridesmaid, never the bride, and it's because we try too hard. We don't try too hard, but it's just like, okay. Calm down.
Yeah.
Like, we'll get there. It's okay.
Cook for yourselves first. Well, you know, you don't have anything to draw people in unless you are cooking for yourself in a defined way where you have a food community. Minneapolis, another example of a town that's gotten a ton of attention. Also does have a really great reviewer in Rick Nelson at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You know, L.A. now was felt overlooked forever. You think you got a chip on your shoulder? You ought to talk to the freaking L.A. people. You know, they've got this whole thing that the Beard Foundation hates them and blah, blah, blah. You know, none of it is really true. It's just that people weren't getting there enough or were overwhelmed by what was there when they got there. So, you know, that's a part of it here, I think, is that we need to have a defined idea of what we are supporting and what we are about. And then you have people who come in who know what the narrative is
when
they get here.
So who would you expect or who should be helping define that? Should it be driven up by the chefs or should it be... Should it be coming? I was going to say, I don't think it should be coming from the CRVA, but should there be like some overarching organization that...
No, I don't think it needs to be an organization. The organization is us. You know, those of us who go to restaurants, who support restaurants, who understand what chefs are trying to do, we're a part of that. The chefs themselves are a part of that.
Right.
In understanding what they're providing and who's going to come in and pay, you know, what they need to be paid to do what they do. We did, you know, I kind of feel like in some ways it started to slip away from us a bit because we had this really, really active local food scene here. And now when I go to the farmers markets, there are smaller crowds. It's kind of like it was fashion and then people moved on from it, which made me really sad because you're moving on from something that's very, very valuable. But I think that that's what it has to be. It has to be coming from us, the Charlotte diner, the Charlotte spender, and what we want to support.
Oh, this could be a whole separate episode just about what we pretend that we want and what we actually
want. And what we actually pay for.
Right.
Yeah.
And how much, unfortunately, social media influencers play into that.
Oh, and I feel like it's what you just said is like a microcosm of Charlotte in general. Like, we don't know what we want. So we can't exactly, as Charlotte, so we can't exactly ever define it or figure out. I feel like that's a question that's been asked for as long as I've been living back in Charlotte in the 90s. And, you know, so it's, I feel like it's maybe just kind of the thing that we're still trying to figure a lot of.
I think for a long time, we had this weird story about ourselves in Charlotte where we were always the high school sophomore. We were always the treasurer on this. I used to tell people, Charlotte is the treasurer of your student council.
I was the treasurer of my student council.
Here's the thing. The treasurer is not the sexiest person, but they're also the one to make sure you got money to have a nice prom.
Oh, that is exactly my whole situation right there.
You just being the
nailed
treasurer?
Me in a nutshell.
The treasurer is good. Stuff doesn't happen without a treasurer. But, you know, you go to some of these bigger cities that are more successful and more well-known than we are, and you know, sorry, I like living in Charlotte. I like our lifestyle.
Yeah, I hear you. 100%.
And, you know.
All right. I've got another question for you, Kathy. Purvis, you wrote an article a few years ago.
Which one?
In the Bitter Southerner.
Oh, Lord.
Which we do love.
Yeah.
And it was a piece on how barbecue-obsessed, bourbon-loving men are taking over Southern food writing. So I want to know, where did that idea for that come from? How did that go over? Was there backlash?
Oh, Lord, how much time you got?
Has there been any improvement?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yes, there has been, actually.
Do we know what year that was?
Oh, Lord, let me think. It all runs together. Was it 2014?
So not that long ago.
2013,
it's not like you were writing it in the 90s.
Something like that. Yeah. Oh, no.
It was sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that came out of conversations a lot of us female women had been having sort of in the back rows of the Southern Foodways symposiums every year. The Southern Foodways Alliance is this really cool organization. Let me say on the top. Big supporter of Southern Foodways. Southern Foodways has done a lot for food in the South and recognition of food in the South. But it also got to be a clique for a while there. Still is in a lot of ways. And you would go and it would be a lot of many of the men who were not from the South who liked to come down and sort of live a pretend Southern life for a few days and, you know, drink a lot of bourbon and eat a lot of barbecue and then go back to, you know, Minnesota or wherever
it was.
Do
they go back? I'm not sure they all go back.
Some of them don't.
Stick around.
Yeah, some of them stick around. You know, that I'm so sick of that saying, I'm not born in the South, but I got here as soon as I could. You know, okay, fine. But yes, there is a lot of inequity for women. You know, and it wasn't just the Southern food writing world. You know, when I was doing that article, I was looking at research on awards, and the National Magazine Awards, no woman had ever won.
What?
Yeah. The top awards. The MFK Fisher Award for the Jane Beard, no woman had ever won. There were women who had been nominated, but no woman had ever won that. So there is a tendency for a certain kind of sort of ballsy writing, attitude writing. For a long time there, the editors who were men were very uncomfortable with women writing that way. The old women aren't allowed to be funny thing. Women aren't allowed to have an attitude unless it's a certain kind of sassy thing, you know. So there was a lot of that going on, and that was starting to really bug me, and I was starting to look at the speakers at Southern Foodways who, you know, tended to be predominantly male. And that was because the person in charge of that organization was reaching out to people he knew, and the people he knew were the people he hung out with, and the people he hung out with were men.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things that I was hitting on that was, wait a second, you know, we're not giving everyone a chance at the table. And that doesn't just mean that women have to imitate the writing voices of men to be accepted. It was also that subjects that mostly involve women were considered less sexy, less interesting. And so there was a lot of that I saw going on. And as to whether or not that changed, it has. And there are women that have who stepped up afterwards, who told me that when they read that, they felt like they were reading their own story and were emboldened to step forward. And really put themselves out there more. Sandra Gutierrez would be one of them. Mm-hmm. Sandra was a great example. When Southern Foodways needed someone who could speak to the Latino South, the person they put up on the stand, great guy up on the dais, Gustavo Arellano from the Orange County Register at the time. He's at the LA Times now as a part of that rebuilding of their food section. And he was wonderful. He wrote a column for a long time called Ask a Mexican. That was, you know, one of these really hilarious columns. He was very funny. But here was Sandra, who lived in Cary, who was living the life of a Latina who was adjusting her food and her cooking to Southern ingredients. Mm-hmm. She was living the life that they were bringing Gustavo in from California to talk about. That was the perfect example, and I didn't know about it until after I wrote that piece. Okay. And Sandra, since then, has gone on. She's been a speaker at Southern Foodways. She's written for Smithsonian Magazine. She's done some really remarkable and amazing things. And I think that it would be fair for Sandra that Sandra would express to me, yes, you pushed me forward. You made me stand up and say, hang on a second, I need to be at this table, and I'm tired of you guys pushing me away. So Sandra would have been the example of where it did change. As far as pushback, oh Lord, yes. Shall we talk about Mean Girls?
Was it from women you got pushback?
The staff, yeah. The staff, interestingly, the staff at Southern Foodways is predominantly women. And I refer to them in my article as support staff. And they actually like got so mad. They said, you called us support like we're bras and girdles. Well, no. You're the people sending out all the stuff. You're the people standing at the tables making sure everybody gets their badge
like, literally
when they walk in.
The
sorry. Yeah. What do you do? There are women who are beyond that and who lead great things at that organization, like, you know, Sarah Camp Arnold and, you know, some really smart women. But I went to an event. They asked me to come and speak at another event right after that piece came out. And yes, indeed, that was like,
I was going to say, they didn't rescind it and be like, oh, suddenly we got the date
wrong. No. They wanted me up there. They wanted me up there for, you know, spitting and glaring at purposes. And so I had to warn that little gauntlet and stand up. And, you know, I gave a talk called Rights Like a Girl. And it was, you know, uncomfortable. And some of the members of the Southern Foodways Alliance office staff were very rude to me. Mostly they would just cut me. They would walk up to a table and like talk to all the women at the table and then look at me and do this sort of sniff a nose in the ear thing. It was hilarious. We were all laughing hysterically. The women I was with who were like, oh my God, really? Are we in high school? Seriously? But yeah, you know, if it, sometimes you have to shake people up a little bit and say, here's the mirror. Here's what you look like. You don't realize outside your own organization what you're looking like. And that's what I had to do. And I, you know, I also feel like I did burn some bridges there and found out that actually burning a bridge is not a bad thing.
No,
because it just forces you to go down the river and find another way to cross.
Well, yeah.
Right.
And that's what I did.
That has been my experience with choosing which clients to work for. I've worked with some people, some organizations that other people might not find palatable or, you know, they don't necessarily agree with. And my dad actually is the one who's like, are you really sure? Are you sure you want to work with Planned Parenthood? Are you sure? What are people going to think? And I was like, if they don't like it, that's their problem.
Right. Yeah.
It's not mine. If they don't like it, then they probably weren't my people anyway. So,
you know, when you lay your cards on the table like that, it gives other people an opportunity to show you who they are. Right.
Oh,
and,
100%.
And then, you know, and then, you know, and you're like, okay, we'll file that.
Yes.
Right,
yes, I still have an uneasy relationship with the head of Southern Foodways, who I adore, who's someone I really love, respect, and admire, and yet there's always this little dig underneath whenever I talk to him now, and you know, it's C'est la vie.
I was going to say, that's his problem, not yours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
So let's talk about freelance writing. I feel like new people, world. But I feel like people have a very romanticized view of what freelance writing is about.
Like, I sure do.
Like, you get to go drink all the drinks and eat all the food and jet about the country to cover stories. Mm-hmm. No. I know that's not the case.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to somebody who is considering a career in freelance writing, and in what ways has the freelance life been different from your newsroom life? Because you've been, when did you leave The Observer? February?
February 28th.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had been setting up a freelance life a long time before that, which was in fact deliberate. I knew I could see the handwriting on the wall. Mm-hmm. I knew where that road was going to lead. And so I started doing books and freelance writing, you know, on my off time. Mm-hmm. And now I sort of have that little boat I could jump into. First of all, disabuse yourself of the notion that you will be able to support yourself. Yeah. Unless you're extremely organized. Now, it is true, there are people who do, and I know people who do, and I am right now, but I also had a lot of years of a steady paycheck to get ready for that.
Right. I was going to say, I always, when people say, well, you should write, I'd be like, honestly, the only reason I have never pursued freelance writing is because I am, at my core, too lazy to do it, because you only get paid if you actually work, and that means constantly pitching.
Looking for overlaps, looking mm-hmm. for, you know, so far I've been very lucky. I really haven't had to pitch much because the editors that I work with, for the most part, know my field, know my writing voice, right. And they come to me.
That's awesome.
Mostly. Mm-hmm. One thing that you will encounter that's kind of a shock to people is that you won't be paid on time, even if you are paid.
That's just freelance life in general.
That's freelance
right?
life. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you were the last one paid. and that's, you know, it's funny because they want you to have your articles in on time, and then they, you know,
take 6 weeks.
They
to pay
take
you.
6 months sometimes mm-hmm. to pay you, and
what?
There you are. Yeah, yeah, and even major magazines will do that to you. I've had that happen.
6 months is insane.
Yeah, no kidding.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, if they start to get into trouble or they feel like their budget is tightening up, then fact that they already paid for that and it was in print, well, you know, who needs to pay for that now?
Oh
so you
gosh.
Have to, you do have to get good at rattling their chains, you know, regularly. You still owe me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's that, but also I'm lucky in that I have a community. You know, because I have been involved in the national food writing world for a long time, Association of Food Journalists, James Beard Foundation, I know people, Southern Foodways, I know people all over the country. And so I'm not as isolated as some freelancers are. And I know freelancers who will consult with you if you pay them. Again, mm-hmm. their time is worth money, but who are doing it and working it really well. An example would be Naomi Tomke in Seattle, who's a really excellent and active freelance writer in Seattle. And she wrote a great piece for one of the magazines right before I left The Observer. I printed it out. I keep it on my desk on sort of how to make it pay. I've always been into professional training. So every opportunity I have at, you know, Association of Food Journalists mm-hmm. or something to go to a seminar where I hear people talk about how they do this, that kind of stuff. I've been saving those notes for years, you know, how you do it. How do I do it? That was good.
So how, I know I've run, even now 10 years removed from the newsroom, for me, I'm still running into situations where I'm kind of like still applying my journalistic principles to a scenario, but that's actually, it's a little bit different when you're doing freelance because
you're a paid gun.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're not necessarily bound by the very strict, very black and white rules of a newsroom. So how do you navigate that, or have you had an opportunity to navigate that?
I actually have. Yeah, I recently, that came, I had my first opportunity to be an influencer.
You're already an influencer.
Which sort of freaked
me out.
But
now you get paid to influence.
Well, someone offered to pay me to influence on something. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I really had to think through what's my ethics policy now?
Mm-hmm.
Because I always had an easy answer on those before, and now I don't. And in this case, I did sit down with several friends, mm-hmm. editors. One of my magazine editors I work with all the time, I immediately went to him and said, does this sully me in your eyes if I do this? And we talked about what the implications were. And actually, I am going to do it because they're not asking me to endorse a product. They're asking me to write about an ingredient that's involved in that product. And I said, okay, I can do that because I know that ingredient. It's something I believe in. It's something I can write about. And along with that, I'll be mentioning this client is adding that ingredient to their product line.
So does that include part of the contract. Well, no. I'm not trying to figure out who it is anymore. I will figure it out, just probably not within the hour. I'm more interested in kind of like the business side of it. Yeah. So did their contract or did their ask include like Instagram posts and stuff like that? Or is it more just strictly content?
It's
that
more
they
content
will be sharing
in this
some
case.
Okay.
Yeah. They have me writing something that would be considered advertorial in their placement of it, but it was something that I don't feel bad about.
Right.
So I decided, well, let's go ahead and see, you know, just like the Southern Foodways piece on the, you know, on the Bitter Southerner, that was one of those things where I just took my breath and, you know, held my breath and jumped off the cliff.
Mm.
Sometimes you have to hold your breath and jump off the cliff and, you know,
I was
see what happens
that
when
is
you
pretty
come to the
much
surface.
Just like entrepreneurial life in
yeah.
general.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So this is a new one for me. And if it turns out I completely scotch my reputation, well, you know, what are you going to do? You'll go find another way to do it.
I was going to say, you can, I am quite capable and adept at overthinking things myself into paralysis. And at some point, you just got to be like, fuck it. I got to try it at least once. You'll never truly know unless you do it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And as long as you feel good about it, like through the negotiation, you don't feel like you've been taken advantage of and stuff like that.
I trust the person who asked me to do it. I don't think she would ask me to do something. It's somebody who used to be an observer editor or works, you know, for a marketing firm now. And, you know, she came to me with this and I thought, well, you know, if this were really that bad an idea, I trust her enough that I don't think she would have asked me to do it. But we had a
more
real
clues.
Open conversation.
I will figure
about
out what
that.
This is. Because Purvis won't tell me, but I will figure it out. So what do you got working? What are you working on now? You got new books?
I'm supposed to be working on a new book. I've had so much freelance that I'm behind in my book work. I do have another food travel book that I'm working on now that's a Southern food, sort of like the distilling book, which was a tour of the South through the lens of Southern craft distilling. And now I'm doing something that is similar to that, about getting around the South and having food experiences. I'm behind because I've had so much work come my way that I've been having a ball with. I just finished up a really big project for Garden & Gun for September, I think, on barbecue and sort of 21st century barbecue, what the new and exciting barbecue places are going to be.
Okay.
That was really fun. I had a great time doing that. Doing a piece for Our State magazine on Moravian cookies that will be,
yeah.
I think, for November.
The Moravians.
The Moravian cookie thing. I went up and did like a deep dive into the Moravian cookie world, and it was really a blast. One of the things I've got that I got to work into the story was I get to diss Martha. And we don't have to say her last name, do we?
No.
Martha. We all know Martha. Yes. I found a Martha connection to Moravian cookies. That's a scream.
Wow.
And so I'll be doing something with that. So, yeah, I've got and I'm right now I'm also getting around a lot because our state also has me doing a global dive in Charlotte, global food dive. And luckily, my son is home for the summer. He's a graduate student at Chapel Hill, and he loves to explore and eat any nationality I point him toward. So he's my second stomach. we've been hitting Vietnamese and
that's super
Peruvian.
Cool. I'm very excited to hear
Korean.
Going back to Charlotte having a chip on their shoulder. I believe Charlotte has a chip on their shoulder about our state also as a city because we don't feel
not
like
the magazine. The state.
I think Charlotte. No, I think. Well,
our state is a magazine.
I know, but I think Charlotte has a chip on its shoulder about everything. But Charlotte feels like it should be included in all publications. And I think, at least in terms of food, they have not felt adequately represented in our state.
The Triangle gets more attention, and so does Asheville, because they are. Remember, one of the places that attention goes is where travelers go.
True.
And Charlotte is not a tourist city. Well, okay, the CRVA would be, if this was Mike Collins' phone-in show, the CRVA would be calling right now going, yes, people come here. They do, but they come here for business or they come here for family and they eat while they're here. They don't come here specifically because they've got 20 places on their list they want to eat, which you do when you go to Asheville and you do when you go to the Triangle.
True.
And when you go to Charleston. You know, those are places that draw people for a food tourism. We aren't there yet, but we have a lot more than people realize we do.
Yes. I'm very excited I was looking at pictures of you and Chris eating your way around Charlotte, and I can't wait to read that story. I think that's going to be great.
Yeah, it's fun. In fact, I'm leaving here after we finish and going over to Tamales La Pasadita.
Yum.
Okay. This is on one of the places on my list that I'm getting to this time.
I have a very deeply meaningful question to ask you, Kathy. And it is, I heard,
oh Lord,
that you did not like Wine Country, the movie.
Ah, it's true. I didn't. I thought it was very, you know, the humor was sophomoric. It was almost like it was people writing about what they think women think are funny and what's actually funny. And I just,
I was a big fan of it when it first came out, but now I can see that. But it wasn't as across the board funny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The story didn't work for me. There were too many inconsistencies and improbabilities in the story. Like I put it out of my head. So, but toward the end when they end up in the emergency room.
Yes.
You know, it's like, if this is supposed to be Sunday afternoon, how did they get in there that quickly? You know, there were all kinds of things like that that were just sort of like, and there were limited things that I found amusing. The Fran Drescher thing, where they go to a gallery and a winery, and the person has all this conceptual art about Fran Drescher and the nanny. That I found funny.
Right.
You know, I thought that was amusing. But there was an awful lot of other things that the storyline just didn't hang together.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. My book club didn't like it either. You and I might be the only two people that liked it.
I know. Yeah. I truly enjoyed my favorite part of it, which I'm sure is no one else's favorite, was when they see, I'm not a big fan of Brené Brown, but I know that I'm the only one who's not. But when they're asking her like a million questions all at once, and the one friend who is like super trepidatious about everything was like, how do I judge people less but also reconcile it with the fact that I hate everyone? And I was like, she's me. Oh my God.
The one thing that did, and you saw it, I'm sure you saw that I tweeted it out, is the one thing that tickled me in that movie was when they went into the kitchen and they had my coffee maker.
Okay, what is
I have
deal?
This really bizarre yes. coffee maker.
The Mocha Master.
The Mocha Master by Technivorn. Yeah, it's a Norwegian coffee maker that is a great coffee maker, but it looks really weird. And it is like,
is it difficult to use?
No. Easiest really? Thing in the world. Although
they did
I'll
make
tell
a joke
story.
Around that.
A
right?
New York Times writer called me recently because she had bought one on my recommendation and she said, I don't know how to use it. And I was like, okay, let's talk it through. It's real easy. You know, I wrote a piece for extracrispy.com uh-huh. on my coffee maker. Which,
so what about
know,
it makes it, because it's like $300, right?
Yeah, it is. Although I got mine. That's part of the story I wrote for Extra Crispy. I got mine for $50.
What? Somebody couldn't figure it out and sold it to you for $50.
No, no. Amazon screwed up and sent me two.
What?
What? Yes. The what do they call them? The fairies of Amazon's warehouse. You know, the sort of, you know, the two fairies.
Like when you get extra stuff in a box
yeah.
that you didn't order, and except you got
yeah,
two coffee
except
makers.
They, yeah, I got two $350
coffee
makers.
That's not like it was
makers.
An extra tiny thing in a box.
Well, I know. I called them and said, how do I send this back to you? And she said, you don't. You keep it. And I said, I can't keep it. It's a $350 coffee maker. And she said, yeah, you can. I said, okay. So I went on Facebook and I offered it for sale for $250. I gave a person a break. So I sold it for $250 to a friend who wanted it and was really excited to get it at, you know, like almost $100 less.
Yes.
And that meant that mine cost me $50.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. What makes it great, Rachel, is that the innards are copper. And those of us who write about distilling know that copper is a magic metal. And one of the things that it does really well is heat. And so, and it also removes impurities. Copper has this magical ability to remove impurities from water. So you get very nice hot water for premium extraction of your coffee flavors. And when you have three people in your house who are all adults and go through a ridiculous amount of coffee.
I was going to say, we drink a lot of coffee too, and we are very hard on our coffee makers.
Yeah, yeah. And ours is like a whole routine in our house, yeah.
There's a few other things I want to ask you about. And one of them is, we must have the conversation about the Starburst dinnerware that you and I both have.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you have an entire
Franciscan,
set of that?
I do. I have more than a set. We Did also you... even now have matching cushions on our dining room chairs.
What? How much of it do you have? I mean, is it from your family or
no.
did you just you like it, it?
Okay, so my husband and I collect mid-century modern stuff. We were into mid-century modern long before other people were. We were raised in Florida, so we were sort of, you know, baptized in this stuff as children. And so one time a friend of mine had five dinner plates that her aunt had given her. When she was starting her first apartment, her aunt had said, here's some dinner plates. Take these. And they were the five, you know. And the neat thing about the Starburst dinner plates is they're asymmetrical.
Yes.
They're not perfectly round. Mm-hmm. They're, like, strangely shaped. Mm-hmm. And she knew we had a whole house full of this kind of stuff. And so she gave us five dinner plates. And then we just started looking for it because it's very distinctive. It's easy to spot in a stack of dishes.
Same, you have the same dishes, Dad?
I have them.
Yeah. And then people started giving me things. They'd clean out their attic and go, oh, hey, I found, you know, a cocoa pitcher. And, you know, I have all kinds of
stuff. Man, we need to talk about this. This is another whole episode, but we need to talk about that. But I need to see more of your collection.
You do.
How much do you have? Do you have, like, the coffee pot and the pitcher and the...
I have the cocoa set. I have the oil and vinegar cruets. Oh. I have the gravy boat and the ladle.
I have gravy boat and ladle. But my ladle doesn't have the Starburst on it.
Oh, mine does. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. I have two sets of the salt and pepper shakers. I have full service for 16.
Wow.
We just sort of made a hobby out of roaming.
Okay.
Yeah, for a while there. So, yeah.
I won't make the mistake of being like, so where do you pick? Where do you get your stuff? Because people who are hardcore about it, like Donna, be like, I'm not telling you.
Well, the thing is, though, is that, let's face it, eBay took all the fun out of it. Freaking old. You know, I started collecting at flea markets a long time ago.
Before flea markets were cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and when flea markets were cool. Mm-hmm. And now eBay has replaced all that. And it's like, you know, when you can just go in and type in, you know, whatever and go find it, that's no fun. That's not fun.
I agree. And I found my first Starburst at the Assistance League here.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember when I walked in and I saw it, it was like a light shone down.
Yeah. Like, don't talk about the Assistance League.
Yes, it was the angels going, ta-da! Yeah.
It's like a secret thrifting spot for
that
my
was a
favorite.
Segue, but I love when you post pictures. I mean, I love the food that you're posting too, but I'm always like, what? Wait a second.
I get
She's got beautiful glassware too. I mean, this is a whole nother.
We've got all kinds of stuff that matches. But remember, my family's from West Palm Beach. And so for years, we would go down to West Palm Beach to see my folks. And then my husband and I would just go hit
the thrift stores
in West Palm Beach. And that stuff ends up down there because people retire, they move down there, they either shed their stuff or, can we be gross and true, but people die and their kids go, I don't want this crap. Right. And they dump it in the Goodwill in West Palm Beach.
Yep.
So that was my little secret for a long time.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have more questions about thrifting and vintage dishware?
I mean, of course I do, but I'll try. I know this is only supposed to be like an hour.
I have a lot of jadeite fire king too.
Ooh, do you?
Yes, I do.
I love jadeite. I only have a tiny bit, but
I have some pretty good stuff in that. Yeah.
Do you use it?
Yeah, all the time. That's one of my husband and I made this rule back when we were doing all this collecting was that the idea of buying stuff just to display it is stupid. So, you know, we don't buy anything we don't use. Yeah. And now I really do. And as I have said in my bourbon book, my house is decorated in early American cocktail. So we have ridiculous number of cocktail shakers, cocktail stuff, cocktail ware. It you know, and so my house is like
Donna's
you know,
a bit obsessed with specific glasses for cocktails.
Yes, I have those too.
I like glassware.
I have a lot of good glassware. I do. And, you know, that's sort of fun. And when people walk into my living room, they're either like, it's actually a great litmus test for whether I like people. Because if they walk into my house and they look around and go, oh, this is weird, I think, well, I don't have to worry about being nice to you. You're not my type.
You're not coming back. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah, go.
Okay. Well, during each episode, we like to ask our guests about their smart mouth life moment. I have to say it very slow or else it comes out all garbled. It's a time when you pivoted, changed course, had an epiphany, or really embraced kind of that smart mouth life ethos. Tell us about your smart mouth life moment.
Well, my whole year has been a smart mouth life moment at the moment because I did completely change my world. But the one that I would tell you about was my Chrissy Teigen moment.
Oh, okay.
I had a Chrissy Teigen moment. And this was in December. I was really bored at work, which was part of the problem, was I was reaching a point of going, this is not challenging me anymore. I'm, you know, why am I doing this? And I, you know, was in that, you know, that trough in late December where everybody's just sort of, you know, running out the clock. I had noticed several people referring to their husbands on Facebook posts and such as their lover. Now, I have nothing against sex. As anyone who knows me knows, you don't grow up with the last name Pervert without having some pretty, you know, being pretty comfortable with some
being
subject.
Okay with sex.
Being okay with it. I also love the idea of love, but I am older. I am 60 years old. And in my youth, the term lover meant one thing, the person with whom one did sex acts, right? Mm-hmm. And now apparently for younger people, it's a little bit different. So I had seen several people use this. And the thing that struck me about it every time wasn't just, wow, that's a little TMI, but also I would wonder what their husbands thought about it. Because let's face it, most of the guys I know, if I were to go into a group of my husband's friends while he's playing pool and talk about him as my lover, he would die of embarrassment. He would drop on the floor and just be like, ah, God, no, don't tell people that. You know, they'd be a little flattered, but they'd also be really freaking embarrassed. And so Chrissy Teigen posted this thing about her husband, John Legend's birthday, and she referred to him as her being her great lover. And I was just like, okay, so fine. So I sent a little tweet saying, basically, I've seen so many people using this and saying this lately, and I'm kind of throwing up in my mouth a little, looking at you, at Chrissy Teigen. Well, Chrissy apparently saw it. I did not know if Chrissy follows me or what, but Chrissy saw it. Chrissy actually commented on it. She retweeted me with a comment, and it was actually sweet and very funny. She was actually very nice about it. It was sort of a, ha-ha, I didn't think about it that way, I see what you mean kind of thing. And then the Chrissy Teigen army raised up their torches and marched on me, the village, and tore me apart for months.
Why? Because you told her that you didn't like a tweet or you didn't like
that.
Way,
and also people
choice.
Took it as I am against love. I am against sex. I am repressed. The thing that killed me was it quickly went to hate speak, like rape talk.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People who were like, you know, you need to be held down and blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But it also, and like one woman, it still makes me laugh every time in a way because it was just so creepy. She said, you know, who hurt you, Kathleen? And I'm like, nobody hurt me. I'm just talking about the language and how people react to it. But people went nuts.
So how did you deal with it?
Well, I have I immediately wondered, did I just cut my throat professionally? But I actually had several friends who are much higher up the food chain than I am on social media who said, actually, you just did yourself a lot of good because you showed that Chrissy Teigen pays attention to you. And also, it was one of the people I know turns out to be involved with a PR agency that does some repping for her. Mm. And they kind of helped me turn it. And then I made sure that I tweeted out, you know, I'm so sorry. I would never have said anything terrible about Chrissy Teigen. She's wonderful. You know, you try and make sure that you mm-hmm. repair the damage right. as quickly as you can and move on, but have a sense of humor about it. I remember sitting in the parking lot at South Park underneath, you know, Belk, mm-hmm. where I was getting ready to go get my haircut. And I'm on the phone with a friend of mine who's a national food writer who's saying, okay, here's how you need to do this. You know, I mean, it right. was like, yeah. And I mean, it was Christmas. And suddenly my entire Christmas was taken up with dealing
managing the
with
Chrissy Teigen fallout.
The Chrissy Teigen fallout and these hate things. And it was just like, whoa, this is interesting. So it was a great lesson in how to be careful on social media and how to be very clear and also recognize that sometimes, you know, when the world appears to be hating on you, it's not bad.
Right.
You know, that was hard for me to learn that, you know, that's actually not always a terrible thing.
It's probably a good time to learn it as you were making the jump, too.
It was. It was. And actually, the other thing that somebody said to me is, okay, so you're 60 years old, and in the social media world, that means your shelf life is running out, and making yourself look like you're still a part of the conversation and willing to say risky things
is for sure.
a really good thing. But you have to be careful, and you have to recognize that when you do that, you know, some people are going to come out of the woodwork and make your life,
right?
You know, the whole Sophia Loren thing that got started this week. There's this whole Sophia Loren thing going on Twitter that came up yesterday, and I still haven't figured out what's going on.
I haven't been on Twitter much. So how many followers did you pick up after that?
About, 50 or 60.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. I've got pretty good Twitter following. I always have.
Between that and the bitter Southerner thing, you're probably you know, you're like the... bad girl of food writing.
I am, and when you're my age, to be the bad girl of food writing at this age is just hilarious.
I very much enjoy you on Twitter because it's like sitting right next to you because you are not at all like no putting on airs. You are 100% you on Twitter.
You know, well, Twitter plays in my wheelhouse because, you know, before I became a food writer, I was a copy editor, and copy editors write headlines. Mm. And headlines are something you have to do in a very limited number of letters. Mm-hmm. And so Twitter is basically headline writing. you know, true, to be able to do it in 140 characters and express a clear thought and be funny at the same time. I've been doing that for years in headlines. So it was like, yeah, cool. I know this. I can do this.
Plus, I think Twitter moves really fast. And
it does.
Sarcasm generally, or kind of like little bitey comments, work pretty well on Twitter.
But
so.
Yeah, but you have to be. I got a lot of engagement on one the other night after the Democratic debates on that woman, Marianne Williamson, where I said, this is the woman I'm always trying to get away from at a wine tasting. And I got huge amount of retweets on that one and likes. It was really hilarious, but yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen, for coming and hanging out with us. This was so much fun. We could have a whole Kathleen Purvis like month/series. We could come back and talk about vintage.
We could
come back and talk more about journalism. There's
food,
so much stuff.
Cooking.
Cooking.
You know, food. I like to cook. Yeah.
Right. One of these days we have to have actual food while we're doing a podcast.
I started to. I almost stopped at what's the bakery? I never pronounce it right. Villani.
I've not tried there yet, but I've heard
love
incredible
that
things about
it. I love that
it.
Place. And I was driving by this morning on the way over here and thought, you know, I should stop and get you guys some pastries, and then I didn't have time.
But, all right. Well, we'll just do it again the next time.
We'll
totally do it again.
So thank you so much for hanging out.
Yeah. Thanks, Kathy.
Was I smart-mouthed enough?
You are totally smart-mouthing it up.
And I would say you had the opportunity to swear, and you did not even swear that much.
You know, it's the old newspaper training, plus my son. I raised a kid, and, you know, I had to start watching my language when I had a young person in my life.
Yeah, my potty mouth is coming back to bite me in the ass now, because now my kids are old enough that they feel like it's okay to swear in front of me. And I'm like, what did you just say? And then I'm like, that's really hypocritical for me to swear and then not tell them not to. So, oh, well. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. We love music that inspires, and Kathy has shared a handful of her favorite songs, so check out our website and social media accounts for the Spotify playlist that always drops in between our episodes to give you some inspo to get you through your week. Make sure and check us out on smartmouthlife.com and across social media, Smart Mouth Life on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Do you have an idea for the Smart Mouth Life topic? We'd love to hear it. Email us at smartmouthlife@gmail.com. On the next episode of the Smart Mouth Life podcast, Tanya Russ Price of Pop Rock Photography teaches us how to take a picture. Tune in. The Smart Mouth Life podcast is created, produced, and hosted by Donna Scott and Rachel Sutherland, and produced and edited by Bridget B. Sullivan of Creative Canvas Productions. Our theme music is by Jones Lee.